The other faculty member I met with was Dr. Oliver Sartor, and before getting into cases and questions, I asked him about two major issues discussed in the GU Symposium meeting. First, a Phase 3 study of another lyase inhibitor, or terinol, and then a press release that came out in the Phase 3 charted ECOG study of chemotherapy with endocrine treatment in metastatic disease. Dr. Sartor began by commenting on orterinol.
The orterinol trial that was presented at the GU ASCO meeting was really the post-docetaxel setting. And it was pretty simple. It was orterinol versus, say, prednisone. And if you look at the overall outcome, it was negative for the primary endpoint, which was overall survival. But what was interesting about the study, I think, is that it kind of depended on where the subjects were as to what the outcomes were. And for instance, if you look globally at the study, it was negative. But if you looked within areas that were outside Europe and the United States, it actually was a positive study. And there was a tremendous amount of crossover to active agents. One of the things that's become increasingly complicated, Neil, is now that we have more and more agents capable of prolonging survival, that if you do a trial where survival is a primary endpoint and you happen to be on a substandard therapy initially, for instance, prednisone, you can cross over to a multiplicity of active agents and still have a response. And so I think the message from that trial was not so much that orterinol is not an active agent, but that the trial itself was negative on the primary endpoint when you use the intent to treat analysis.
Certainly in terms of PSA reductions, progression-free survival, and other short-term measures of efficacy, it seemed not that much different than what's been seen with abiraterone, or is that too simple of a thought?
No, it's not too simple a thought. You know, there are a lot of mechanistic similarities, and clearly it's an agent that was active, but it's not just about having an agent that's active when it comes to things like FDA approval. You have to have the right trial design and the right population and ensure that your primary endpoint is met. And even though I believe that that was an active drug, the primary endpoint was not met in the intent to treat analysis, and consequently, that is not something that the FDA will approve.
Now, a lot of times we do hear about the issue of where patients are entered geographically, and you referred to that as it relates to this. Is that a more question of what kind of treatment they got outside the trial, you know, afterwards, or was there any kind of sort of pharmacodynamic issue?
No, I think it's how the patients were treated after the trial was actually executed and they met a progression-free endpoint within the trial. I was talking actually to some Brazilian docs, very, very good docs, very well trained. And, you know, they said this is an active agent. And in our country, it's an active agent, but they did not have access to the abiraterones and enzalutamides that might have been available to U.S. docs. So I don't think it has anything to do with pharmacokinetics, dynamics, being variable from population to population. I think it just has really to do with what drugs you have access to.
And is this drug still of interest? Are there ongoing trials that are being looked at? Is it possible the drug's going to end up in practice?
It is possible. There are additional trials that have yet to be publicly released. And as things go forward, you know, I think we do have a concern about the ability to do trials with a survival endpoint. And this drug sort of exemplifies that concern, but it doesn't mean that it's not an active drug, and it could conceivably be available at some point in the future based on a trial with another design.
Can you see any advantage over abiraterone or non-cross resistance? I mean, where theoretically would it fit in?
Well, I think mechanistically that it hits a little bit harder one of the enzymes that abiraterone hits, and it hits less effectively the other. So let me back up just for a second. There are two enzymes that are hit with the abiraterone. One is a 17-alpha hydroxylase, and the other is a 17-20 ketolyase. What you really want to inhibit is a 17-20 ketolyase, and it turns out that there is some selectivity for orterinol for that 17-20 ketolyase. And if you can hit that agent or that enzyme and that enzyme alone, you wouldn't have to be giving people steroids such as prednisone and dexamethasone, which I think would be viewed as an advantage. But, you know, we're not really going to have this one move forward based on the current trial results. But let me just mention that there is an excellent trial being run through RTOG, the Radiation Therapy Oncology Group, now part of the NRG Oncology Group. It takes high-risk patients, and the standard of care for those patients with high-risk localized disease is to treat them with radiation and androgen deprivation therapy. Well, there's a trial that is going to be assessing the androgen deprivation therapy plus ortironol as opposed to minus ortironol. Everybody gets radiation, of course. And, you know, it's conceivable that that trial, which is a large phase 3 trial, will accrue adequately and show some important benefit. And you don't necessarily have to use prednisone with this agent, particularly as you're moving a little bit lower on the dose curve.
So let's move forward with some of the clinical issues that came out in the symposium. As you know, we had cases selected from docs in practice that were presented by video, and one that was presented by Dr. Paul Fishkin, who he was particularly interested to see what you thought about this patient because he was an 80-year-old man, widespread bone mets, had had various forms of systemic therapy, was developing increasing bone pain, and got treated with radium-223. What happened with him was he actually did well. He had an improvement in his bone pain. However, his PSA increased, and the patient was clinically, you know, doing better. The patient did have some nausea, which the doc thought was related to the treatment. So there were a bunch of questions that he had about it, the first being, how often do you see actual clinical improvement, like as was seen with this man? And have you seen any GI toxicity? And it's hard to say whether this was from the treatment or not. He thought it was from the treatment. But what kinds of quality of life and sort of side effects have you seen with radium-223?
There are definitely some improvements in quality of life. If we go to some formal measurements, you know, quality of life is a little bit strange because it's really what you measure on these various validated forms as opposed to what the patients tell you. I'll tell you that a substantial number of patients say, my quality of life is better, that I'm having less pain. One of the limitations of the Alcimca study, which was the phase 3 with radium, is that it really was a survival study and only secondarily had a few endpoints that could be applied to quality of life. In the FACT-P, which was one of the quality of life questionnaires, there was improvement measurable in a greater percentage of patients with radium than placebo. And I think the improvement was, gosh, I think it was about 30% of patients. But I think that's probably an underestimate of what actually occurred. In terms of the GI effects, what I've seen is a little bit of diarrhea, loose stools, rarely what I really call a diarrhea. It's more in the way of loose stools. I have had patients report nausea, and I even had one patient report vomiting. But if we look at the randomized phase 3 results with, you know, 920 patients, the nausea and the placebo and the radium group were actually the same, the percentage of patients developing. But nevertheless, I think that there is the potential to develop a little nausea with the drug. I think I've seen it, but it's hard to really speak knowledgeably because it wasn't measured in the phase 3.
Another issue, how often do you see, and he was curious, the fact that this, at the time we talked to him, the patient was clearly, he felt, no doubt, had improved from the point of view of pain, and yet his PSA was going up.
Right.
Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, great point. I'm sorry I didn't address it initially. So, you know, it turns out that PSA could be coming from a variety of sources. First of all, PSA may not be derived from bone. PSA can be derived from lymph nodes or other disease, including even the primary prostate. And with something like radium, we're treating the bone only. That's a fact. Radium does not go outside of the bone. When I'm using radium, I'm always trying to use it with another active hormonal agent if I can. So the rise in PSA is not something unexpected with a bone-targeted therapy if there's disease outside of the bone. That's point number one. Point number two is in the prospective trial, there was an improvement in the time to PSA progression for the radium-treated patients as compared to placebo. But there wasn't a lot of difference at the median. It was, hazard ratio was good. The hazard ratio was like 0.64 or something in that area. But the median was only a couple of weeks apart. The split mainly occurred after the median was a little bit late. So some of these patients don't necessarily have declines in PSA. They just progress more slowly after the radium. Now, there's another important point, and I actually have helped to co-author an abstract, was the lead author in an abstract at ASCO last year, did look at a variety of parameters that were potentially connected to predicting what would happen to radium-treated patients using overall survival, which was the primary endpoint. What we found is that alkaline phosphatase actually was a pretty reasonable marker for radium activity. And those individuals with a decline in alkaline phosphatase on radium did far better than those who had an increase. The majority declined if we looked at waterfall plots, and the time to alkaline phosphatase progression was substantially delayed. Alkaline phosphatase is thought in this case to be predominantly derived from the osteoblast. And I think there's probably some collateral damage of the radium to the osteoblast, and that affects the microenvironment that these various lesions are growing in. And it could be that PSA is not an ideal marker for radium. In fact, as I'll just say, that it's probably not the best. It could be that alkaline phosphatase is better. And by the way, LDH is also another good one. So we have more work to do. We're working on a manuscript on just this topic, but it's an important point to make.
This doc, Dr. Fishkin, also wanted to know, and now here's an 80-year-old patient he really didn't want to give chemo to, what we know about radium-223 in people who've not had chemo. And in those who have, he brought up this question of, I guess the package insert says you have to wait 4 weeks after the chemo to give radium-223. Do you really need to wait 4 weeks, or can you wait until their counts are recovered?
Yeah, first of all, I think you can just wait till the counts are recovered. The 4 weeks was a bit arbitrary. There are a couple of questions embedded in there, but I think one of the most important things about the Alcimca trial is that there were some stratification factors that were set before the trial ever started. One of these stratification factors was, had the patient received docetaxel or not? And it turned out that about 57% of the patients had received prior docetaxel, about 43% had not. But there was a prolongation of survival in both of those subsets. This is not a drug you have to give docetaxel and then give radium. You can use it beforehand as well. And in the Alcimca trial, the patients who were, quote, unfit for chemotherapy or had refused chemotherapy received the radium. 43% of the patients on the big phase 3 had actually not had prior docetaxel, and they benefited with a prolonged survival as well.
So we got a number of questions from the audience about radium-223. Before I sort of run through them, just sort of taking a step back at this point, where's a typical clinical scenario where you'll use this drug, where you think it should be used?
Yeah, so great question. And first of all, the pre or post docetaxel is not that important to me, if you really want to know the truth, because I think that's more of a regulatory distinction than a biologic distinction, you know, whether or not you have drug X or drug Y. Radium is not going to be cross-resistant with docetaxel. You can clearly have activity, whether it's given before or after. So that's not important. One of the things that is important to me is the extent of soft tissue disease versus the extent of bony disease. You know, this is a bone-targeted agent. It's not going to go to lymph nodes. It's not going to go to liver. If you have a guy with 2 bone lesions and 59 huge lymph nodes, obviously not a good radium patient. On the other hand, if you have a guy with 59 bone mets and 2 little lymph nodes and no visceral disease, he might be a very good radium patient. The other thing that I think is important is you're looking for patients in my practice that I can try to complement it with a hormonal therapy. And I'm using the newer hormones today like we use the older hormones in Alcimca, which was a phase 3 trial. The Alcimca trial did not utilize radium as a monotherapy. It used radium as part of the standard of care. People were getting ketoconazole, bicalutamide, nilotamide, diethylstilbestrol, dexamethasone. They were getting all kinds of hormonal manipulations in addition to the radium because it was standard of care. And they were getting bisphosphonates. Bisphosphonates were thought to be indicated by the physician. And so today we're fast forwarding a little bit, and I'm using the enzalutamides, the abiraterones, in combination with radium in an effort to control not only the bony disease, but hopefully any disease outside of the bone as well. And actually, I've been seeing some really nice results with those combinations.
So does that include using it in the first line?
Yes, it does.
And does it include using it in people who have, you know, let's say only bone mets, but not that many, not that symptomatic, but, you know, you're still using your enzalutamide or abiraterone, that kind of patient still?
Yeah, so very perceptive question. You know, it's one of the things, Neil, and this is an honest compliment. You really get to the heart of the matter very, very quickly.
No,
it's a great question. It's a great question. You know, within the Alsempica trial, there were divisions according to the number of bone lesions. And those people had super scans greater than 20 lesions, between 6 and 20 lesions, you know, unequivocal, clear benefit. When you looked in the Alsempica trial at the 0 to 6 bony lesions, then the benefit was a little less appreciated. Let's just say the confidence intervals were big, but also the numbers are pretty small. So I'm kind of looking at my radium patients to have a little more bony metastasis than one or two. I'm just thinking that, you know, if they're six or higher, I'm a little bit more comfortable. The pain thing, again, very critical issue. You know, within the label, it says, you know, painful or symptomatic bony metastatic disease, castrate-resistant prostate cancer without visceral mets. That's all well and great, but we can alter pain just by an analgesic dose. You know, if a guy comes in and he's taking regular ibuprofen, it may not sound like much, but he may be getting very reasonable pain relief from those ibuprofen. I don't necessarily pay a lot of attention to the pain part, simply because I think it's able to be manipulated by the medications we give, the posture the patient is in, whether or not they had a bumpy ride over to the clinic. You know, there's just a lot of things that can influence that.
So what about a patient with bone-only mets, asymptomatic, about to get CYP-T?
You know, that's a really interesting question. Emmanuel Antonarakis and I, Emmanuel's from Johns Hopkins, are going to be doing a small prospective pilot study using the combination of CYP-T and radium. We haven't started yet, so right now we have a pretty minimal amount of discussion we can engage in without just being completely speculative. But let me point this out, that there is a potential synergy in multiple animal models between radiation and immunologic therapy. And I think it's an idea that needs to be explored. I'm not really ready to do it in the clinic because I just don't know what's going to happen. But on the other hand, this is an idea with the interactions between radiation and immunologic therapy that needs to be explored.
Radiation and immunologic therapy, is that about sort of antigen exposure or something?
Yes, it is. If you go to the preclinical models, you can actually see that radiation will upregulate antigen expression in a substantial number of models. This is not a prostate sort of driven concept. This is just really broad cancer. And you may remember in the ipilimumab trial that in the post-chemo setting, they were given a shot of radiation with the idea that they were going to try to trigger some antigen exposure and then be able to prime the immune system with better. So it's kind of the same concept. You know, when you treat with radiation, and radium, of course, is one form of radiation, it's potentially possible that you're going to be enhancing antigen exposure in a way that could be beneficial for the patient. No way to prove it, but there's lots of animal models to say that that's reasonable.
So let me throw out some of the questions that came in from the audience during the symposium about radium-223. This one I didn't really get exactly, but maybe it's just over my head. Should you use height rather than weight to calculate radium-223 dose?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question. Let me tell you the basis. So when you're trying to assess the skeletal mass, weight is probably not the best way to do that. You know, we have guys that are 5'7" and they've got a skeletal mass and they have a weight of 59 kilos. And then we have guys that weigh 259 kilos, the same height. Their skeletal mass is probably about the same. And there have been folks who've suggested that modifying the dose by some sort of height-based mechanism would be better than a weight-based mechanism. What we can say in sort of the answer to that is right now it remains an untested concept, but it's completely reasonable.
So, yeah, that's interesting. A couple other questions. Do patients need oral exams prior to radium-223? And another sort of complication kind of question, radium-223 and risk of MDS, and I'd add in myelosuppression.
Yeah, so the oral exam is really driving at O&J, osteonecrosis of the jaw, which is, of course, a known complication of denosumab and zoledronic acid and other bisphosphonates. It turns out that there's never been any reported cases of O&J within the radium-treated groups. But, I mean, eventually somebody's going to show up, and whether or not it's radium or bisphosphonate or whatever, you know, who knows. But so far, oral exams are really not part of what I do prior to radium. I just don't think it's necessary. And MDS myelosuppression. So, you know, there's a concern with any radiopharmaceutical that you could end up with some MDS or end up with substantial myelosuppression. And if we go back to the phase 3 trial, what I can say is if you compare the radium-treated group with the placebo group, that the risk of neutropenia was 1%. Of course, that's just one cell line. The risk of anemia, either overall or grade 3-4, between the radium and placebo groups were exactly the same. There was a little bit of difference in thrombocytopenia. It was about 6.5% grade 3-4 in the radium-treated group. And I think it was 2%, if I remember correctly, in the placebo group. But anyway, there's a little bit of thrombocytopenia grade 3-4. Now, there are some patients who end up with pancytopenia. But the truth is that can happen in prostate cancer regardless of whether or not you're treated with radium. And the definitions of pancytopenia are a little bit variable. What I'll say is that I have had, it's either 4 or 5 patients in my practice that have developed what I consider to be thrombocytopenia. I marrowed every single one of them. What did I find? 4 of the cases I found marrows packed with prostate cancer, and 1 case, really, really bizarre, the patient had myeloma. Multiple myeloma.
Wow.
And it was undiagnosed. This guy had a PSA of 500, multiple blastic lesions. No question he had metastatic prostate cancer. And yet when he developed pancytopenia, we married him and he had multiple myeloma. I can't believe that it developed because, you know, it started like 2.5 months after he got his first radium dose. But it was just one of those weird things.
Hmm.
But anyway, the bottom line is I think there is a theoretical risk. It turns out that we do need to monitor it going forward. There was a presentation at GU ASCO looking at the long-term safety profile, and that was presented by Sten Nilsson, who's a very accomplished investigator over in Sweden. And using the longest-term follow-up available, we really did not see the myelodysplasia.
So relevant to that longer-term follow-up, another question came in about secondary cancers with radium-223.
You know, one day we're going to see them, I suspect, if people live long enough, but we haven't seen them yet. In the long-term radium studies, and there were some very bizarre long-term radium studies. Actually, let me tell you a little bit about that because it's so bizarre, it sort of stretches your imagination. Radium, in the form of radium-226, was at one point given to people for arthritis and tuberculosis many, many, many years ago, back in the 1930s.
Wow.
And they weren't using radium-223. They used radium-226, had a very long half-life. It's called the SPIES study, after the person who kind of put it together and collated it eventually, S-P-I-E-S-S. You can Google that, the SPIES study. And I did, of course, and it's pretty amazing because it was superb records kept. And these were in Germany, and the people were getting these radium treatments. And then years later, and now we're not talking about years later, I'm talking about, you know, 7, 15, 20, 30 years later, it's a very high risk of osteosarcoma in these patients.
Hmm.
As another example of radium causing secondary cancers, and you're old enough, you might remember this, radium glows in the dark, and it used to be put on watch faces so you could see where your dials were at night. You know, they had little radium dots painted on there so it would fluoresce at night. The people who were putting that radium on, the so-called radium dial painters, were dipping their little brush in a pot of liquid radium and then painting it onto the watch dials. And then they would lick the paintbrush in order to sharpen it up and do it again. They ended up with very substantial radium exposure. They ended up with some osteosarcomas and a few things like in the maxillary sinuses, presumably, you know, just repetitive radium exposure. Radium is an alpha emitter. It can result in cancer with longer-term follow-up, but it's not anything short-term. One day we might see it, and there are a variety of registries and things designed to look at this over time with radium-223, a different isotope. Radium-226 was the one used in a variety of the early studies. The half-life differences are immense. Radium-223 is 10 or 11 days, and radium-226 has got a half-life of, like, I don't know, 1,600 years or something. So there might be one day some radium-223 secondary cancers. So far, they have not been seen.
Actually, I was starting to think about the putting it in their mouth before you said it, so I must have some kind of antiquated memory, maybe from med school, hearing that story. Here's another question. Is it safe to combine radium with denosumab, and I'd add bisphosphonate?
Yeah, so within these stratified analysis of the Alsimca trial, there was a stratification for use, no use of bisphosphonates, which is predominantly zoledronic acid, and there were no safety concerns that were alleviated. In fact, it's from the skeletal-related event perspective, the hazard ratio for symptomatic skeletal events, absolutely, it was safe and certainly effective. Now, the denosumab was not available at the time of the Alsimca trial, but I personally have been using denosumab in the same manner that I would be using zoledronic acid. I certainly have not seen any interaction that I'm worried about.
So do you sort of make those two decisions independently, and then if it's yes, do both?
Well, you know, for the individuals that have high-volume bone metastatic disease, you know, we have excellent data to show that denosumab or zoledronic acid can reduce skeletal-related events, radiation to bone, fractures in bone, and the like. And this is also true with radium. And so many of the patients who might benefit from one are potentially likely to benefit from the other. I often do have a use of denosumab or zoledronic acid in my patients with substantial burden of bony metastatic disease. If they've got a solitary rib lesion, no. But at the same time, using these agents in the way that they're FDA approved, I think makes perfectly good sense. And it doesn't interfere with my decision to give or not give radium. I give radium independently of the denosumab or zoledronic acid.
Now, when I was asking you about sort of the algorithm and where radium-223 fits in with metastatic disease, it sounded like you would treat a patient who is asymptomatic. Is that correct?
Correct.
And yet, Dr. Fishkin, who presented this case that I was telling you about, was telling me that his impression was, or his understanding was, or his reimbursement people were telling him that you need the patient to have pain in order to, I guess, give the drug. Is that true?
Well, you know, the way the Alsimca was designed, it encouraged people to have, quote, symptomatic disease. But symptomatic, literally in the Alsimca trial, could be taking one acetaminophen a day. So if they took one acetaminophen a day, they were declared to have had pain. They could also have pain if they received external beam radiation and then had no pain. But if they had prior external beam within, say, 12 weeks, then that would count as being symptomatic. So the way symptomatic was counted in the phase 3 trial is a little bit problematic, and it's not as black and white as you might think. What he's probably referring to is in the label, in the FDA-approved label, it says the patient should have symptomatic disease. And, you know, that's a little bit in the eye of the beholder, as I talked about earlier, because, you know, I have honestly had people come in and say, I'm taking two acetaminophen a day, and if I didn't, it would really hurt, but I take the acetaminophen, and that's sufficient to relieve my pain. That patient is symptomatic, according to the definition that was used in the trial. So you don't have to be up there taking opioids or anything. I think a little bit of symptoms is probably appropriate, or a recent history of radiation. But because of the vagaries associated with pain and no pain and the vagaries associated with analgesics, no analgesics, I'm kind of assessing my patients on other parameters primarily.
Okay, that sounds interesting. He also had asked about repeat radium-223 treatments. Can they be done? And when you do a repeat, do you do the whole, you know, six cycles again?
Great question. There's a clinical trial to answer that question that's recently opened. So I don't really have any experience with giving repeat radium. Ironically, my coordinator is contacting a patient today to try to get some more information to determine his eligibility.
So you haven't repeat treated on anybody?
No.
This is interesting. I didn't know about this. Requirement for a hemoglobin of 10 for radium-223. Can you give EPO to raise the hemoglobin?
You know, I think that hemoglobin of 10 is a little bit like pain in my mind. It, first of all, is a little bit arbitrary. You know, how did you come up with 10? Well, Neil, I happened to be in the room when we came up with 10. I was part of the trial design. And, you know, it's like you and I are sitting here and you said, oh, well, you know, what do you think the hemoglobin ought to be? And you say 9.5. I said, no, 10.5. And you said, okay, we'll make it 10. And, you know, honestly, it was an arbitrary decision. It was not a data-driven decision. So first of all, I don't really think that the hemoglobin of 10 is something that needs to be gospel, so to speak. If you felt better by using a hemoglobin greater than 10 in your practice, sure, use a little EPO to get there if you want to. Just use it according to the indications. Use EPO according to the indications. I'm really more focused on the platelet parameters, the white cell parameters. And if the hemoglobin's, you know, 9.7, I promise you it's not the end of the world. And I certainly have treated a number of patients whose hemoglobin was a little less than 10. It's not, you know, like I said, don't take that as gospel.
Someone wants to know whether you still use strontium.
I do not.
Growth factors with radium-223.
You know, I've been a little bit reluctant to use it unless I knew the radium had washed out of the system. The neutropenia is so rare. I mean, literally 2% grade 3, 4 versus 1% of the placebo group. I've not used growth factors, but I would point out that unlike chemotherapy, which is cleared out of the system pretty quickly, radium does have an 11-day half-life, and you don't want to be probably injecting the growth factors shortly after the radium because those cells are going to get a lot of radium exposure.
Someone wants to know about using local, you were mentioning this before, localized radiation therapy for pain with radium-223.
All the time. You know, I sort of divide my patient's symptoms into focal and systemic issues. And I've had such good success working with my radiation oncologist on focal pain. You know, if a guy has a sore shoulder, then use external beam. You don't have to use 29 fractions. You can use, you know, one fraction, five fractions, whatever. Weight bearing would generally go to 10. But if the patient can put their hand over the pain and say, this is where it hurts, and it's in the skeleton, then I'm thinking about external beam radiation. And it's perfectly safe to use radium and external beam all in the same patient at the same time.
So again, the last thing I want to ask you about is new agents, new developments. And one that we got a lot of questions about and was discussed at the meeting was cabozantinib. Can you sort of review what it is and what we know about it right now in prostate cancer?
Yeah, so it's an interesting agent. I've been an author on several of the peer-reviewed articles that have come out by virtue of participating in some of the clinical trials. Cabozantinib has two activities. It'll inhibit the VEGF receptor 2 in particular, so it's a VEGF receptor inhibitor, but it's also a MET inhibitor. And MET is overexpressed in a lot of prostate cancer cells, particularly the castrate-resistant variety. And this dual inhibition is, in fact, unique. So it's a TKI, it's a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, but with a unique selectivity for the kinases that it's able to inhibit. And within the initial trials, there was a lot of excitement because bone scans actually got better, some dramatically better. Now, it turns out that these dramatic improvements in bone scan were not typical. It was more typical you'd get some improvement in bone scan, but there were a variety of other potential benefits as well. Patients had less pain, and in addition, they had soft tissue lesions that would actually shrink. If you look at the waterfall plots, a number of patients had either stability of disease in the soft tissue or even some shrinkage. Now, as a consequence of those initial phase 1/phase 2 studies, and there were some randomized discontinuation studies were presented at ASCO. Myles Sain gave presentations on that. It Turns out that there was enough activity to move it into phase three, and there are two phase three trials. One of them is a palliative trial, and another is a survival trial. And the survival trial is going to be reported this year. The interim analysis of overall survival was negative, and it's, let me tell you a little bit about the setting. It's post-docetaxel and post-abiraterone and enzalutamide, so it's patients who've had a lot of prior treatment, and we don't really have a lot that could be effective for them, although maybe cabazitaxel could be effective. But they were randomized to prednisone or the cabozantinib, and we're waiting to hear the results about the mature final endpoint on that trial right now.
So at this point, though, have objective responses been reported to monotherapy with cabozantinib?
Yes.
Have there, I mean, you've had patients like that, I mean, have clinically useful responses, you know, pain relief and, you know, other sequelae of tumor response been seen with monotherapy?
Yes. As a participant in the phase two trial, we have submitted, we have one in peer review. It's already out right now. Another one is pending. One of them is in the JCO. We have seen some clinically meaningful things. I think the thing that concerns me about the cabozantinib, to be blunt, is it is a TKI, and it has TKI-like toxicities. And some of the guys that I treat, you know, they're a little frail, particularly if they've gone through docetaxel and abiraterone, and, you know, they're 84 years old. You know, they're not the strongest guys on the block. And there's some issues, not so much the hand, foot, and stuff, but there's a fatigue, and then there's a loss of taste, and appetites can be impaired, and there's a fair amount of weight loss associated with these drugs. And you can't always lose a lot of weight if you're already a bit cachectic and you're a little frail and you're a little elderly. So, you know, it's like every drug, there are pluses and minuses. Or I think we need to await the phase three results before we, you know, get too opinionated.
I think that oncologists certainly are sensitized to the problems that TKIs can cause. But I guess I was thinking, too, because it seems like we have this discussion in so many different tumors nowadays. You see a lot of trials out there, you know, where things are combined with, let's say, chemotherapy. And it gets really hard to figure out, you know, okay, you have a modest benefit. You can't really tell an individual patient if they're really benefiting. It's kind of a group phenomena. And then you see all these new novel agents coming along. I mean, you see them in almost every tumor, any ibrutinib and, you know, hematologic cancers and brentuximab vedotin, T-DM1 and breast cancer, where, again, you know, you have patients who get just the drug, just that drug, and seem to have clinical benefit. And I guess my question is, should we have the same kind of approach in terms of FDA approval to that kind of a therapeutic strategy as opposed to sort of this combination strategy?
Excellent point. I think that we need new regulatory approaches. I think particularly when you have things like the ALK inhibitors in lung cancer and imatinib when it was initially being used in CML, you know, I honestly don't think you need big randomized studies to make a regulatory call.
And do you need a survival benefit?
You know, I think that you could have an accelerated approval. And now they have the so-called breakthrough designation. You may have seen the breakthrough designation recently that's being utilized. I think that you can try to get the drug out to people who can benefit quickly, and yet at the same time be able to follow patients for their overall survival. I mean, let's look at CML, okay? And I'm using that as a paradigm just because it's a disease we all know. I'm a prostate guy, and I still know CML. If you don't treat CML when it's starting to accelerate and it hits in the blast phase, those patients are going to die. And then you have an oral drug that can put people into complete remission, and it may be years before they're coming out of remission. Do you really need to do a randomized trial of survival in that setting? I don't think so. But with each drug and with each toxicity, I think that there's a tough task before the FDA. First of all, let me say, I'm really, really respectful of what the FDA does on a daily basis. They really are trying to help people, and I know that Rick Pazdur and his colleagues have in their heart that they want to help people who have cancer. They want to get these drugs approved, but they just want to make sure that they're safe and effective in the process. So you know, they're getting a lot of pressure right now. I don't want to be one that puts pressure on them, but I do think we need a regulatory paradigm that shifts as our mechanisms of drug activity shifts and we get better therapeutic benefit in patients with otherwise fatal disease. Let them get that drug early, because there's more harm in letting the drug not be available than having the drug available at times.
No, I totally agree with you about the FDA team. I wish the rest of the federal government operated as well as the FDA does. And they do seem to be, you know, thinking a lot. You know, they just had a neoadjuvant indication in breast cancer for the first time. But I just, you know, and I think it depends a little bit on the clinical situation. But when you get into an end-stage solid tumor, you know, a patient with prostate cancer has been through everything that we talked about today, and you can identify a bunch of people who seem to benefit, it certainly is docs in practice are wanting to get their hands on it.
Well, you know, I think in this case, it's probably appropriate that there be randomized trials because of the toxicity issues. Toxicity is pretty substantial in the phase two and a lot of dose reductions. You know, it started out at 100 milligrams, then went to 60, then went to 40. There's a lot of dose reductions. So I think in this case, I'm not opposed to having a randomized phase three.